Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. I imagine you recognize what you're hearing there. Wolves. These are wolves recorded in Yellowstone National Park for Montana State University's Acoustic Atlas. Why wolves howl is a question that researchers are still kind of grappling with. One reason they might tilt their heads skyward and call out? To audibly mark their territory. Another potential reason? To individually communicate, "Here I am," to their family, their pack, a kind of call and response exercise. Wolf packs also often have a regular communal chorus, maybe as a way of saying, "We're a pack," and it could be a way of strengthening bonds within the pack unit. And then, researchers think that in some instances, howling can be used to communicate the presence or location of prey that wolves are hunting, when they hunt together as a group. Which brings us to ancient tyrannosaur dinosaurs. That's the sound Hollywood ascribes to the giant predators that roamed the Earth tens of millions of years ago. In the Hollywood version, the Tyrannosaurus Rex was a solitary hunter, terrorizing everyone and everything and clashing with other individuals of its own kind in territorial jaw-to-jaw combat. New research from dinosaur fossils found in Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, though, is challenging that depiction of tyrannosaurs. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management hosted a press conference earlier this week, and BLM paleontologist Dr. Alan Titus explained that the lone wolf idea, which when you think about it is kind of a misnomer, has been the prevailing version of how tyrannosaurs operated, but not necessarily the right one.
It's not particularly controversial that dinosaurs were gregarious. We find many fossil sites in which especially plant eaters are buried together in large numbers. So you can imagine these dinosaurs populating areas just like a herd of wildebeest in Africa today. It's a little more controversial when you start talking about gregarious predators, because predators don't instinctively or automatically become gregarious, or at least as readily as plant eaters. So when you think about predators, there really aren't lots of examples today of large predators that behave in complex social groups like wolves or lions. I mean, those are essentially the two best examples we have today. Most predators are solitary. And the reason for that is you have to have a very special purpose as a predator to want to get together and cooperate with what were originally your competitors for prey. And that involves guaranteeing success of taking down larger animals. But it also involves a lot of complex behavior if you're going to actually share in a hunt and have roles in a hunt and have a hierarchical structure with an alpha who's in charge. That takes a fair amount of brain power, maybe a little more than it does just for a plant eater to kind of congregate for self-defense purposes or breeding purposes. So the idea that large predators like T-Rex could have actually been social complex hunters with role playing and division of the hunt, you know, with ambushers and chasers and then sharing in the kills and all that is somewhat controversial, because a lot of researchers feel like these animals simply didn't have the brain power to engage in such complex behavior.
Again, that's Dr. Alan Titus, Bureau of Land Management paleontologist, explaining that the common thinking has been that tyrannosaurs, like the big T-Rex you're familiar with from the movies, were solitary hunters, unlike some of the pretty social plant eaters that they may have preyed upon. However, in 2014, Dr. Titus and his colleagues discovered a fossil trove in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southeastern Utah that held the remains of multiple individuals of the Teratophonius species of tyrannosaurs. Teratophonius, by the way, is a type of tyrannosaur whose remains have so far only been found inside of the Utah Monument. Anyway, several different individuals of this same species of dinosaur of various different ages, meaning very young, adolescent, and adult Teratophonius, all together in the same place. A family, maybe? A pack? Now, these animals lived about 76.4 million years ago. The paleontologists could tell that by the geologic layer that they were found in. So just the fact that they were all in the same acre or so of land when they were discovered in 2014 doesn't necessarily mean that they had all died together. And the story of these fossils is actually extremely complicated, because the ecosystem changed around them, and lakes formed over them and then dissipated, and there was a lot of scientific sleuthing to be done to figure out what exactly had happened. Because another possibility, instead of these animals having all died together at the same time, was that their individual remains had simply all been washed into the same area by river currents in the wet and forested ecosystem of the time. That they had all died in separate places and then had been brought together by the flow of water, maybe to a bend in a river, and then deposited there. The scientific sleuthing involved included analyzing stable carbon and oxygen isotopes and then looking at the concentrations of rare earth elements within the bones and rock. I'm just going to summarize the findings here to tell you that in the end, yes, the evidence from all that analysis pointed to these animals having lived and died together. They probably died in a massive flood, in fact. And just quickly, this isn't the first time that scientists have found evidence of multiple individuals of a species of tyrannosaur living together.
Slightly more than 20 years ago, Dr. Phil Curry from Royal Tyrrell Museum in Canada started excavating a site at this place called Dry Island Buffalo Jump in Canada, and they uncovered the remains of a minimum of 12 individual tyrannosaurs ranging in age from practically just out of the nest all the way to full adults, reaching 25, 30 feet in length. And after they studied the site and the forensic evidence on the bones, concluded that these animals had all died in a single mass kill, a catastrophic event, and that the reason they are all buried together is because they lived together. They were actually some sort of social or gregarious group of tyrannosaurs swept up in a catastrophe rather than individuals wandering into a place one after another or some sort of other mechanism to concentrate them post-death. And from this, Dr. Curry concluded that these tyrannosaurs, if they were gathering in groups and multi-generational, that they were probably behaving more like a pack of wolves than the classic solitary lone wolf predator that T-Rex had been relegated to.
There are actually now three instances of fossils from mass death events that show tyrannosaurs acting this way. So evidence is mounting to show that, you know, multiple T-Rexes may have coordinated to take down big prey and to then share in the spoils. What you're hearing now is not a recording of a dinosaur, though it kind of sounds like it. Actually, wait, yes it is. It's a Harris hawk, a species of bird that lives in parts of the American Southwest and down into Central America, and also in parts of South America. All birds in existence today can trace their origins to theropods, a meat-eating bipedal branch of the dinosaur tree. It's the same branch, by the way, that led to the rise of tyrannosaurs and velociraptors and numerous other dinosaurs that you're familiar with. So why am I suddenly playing you this modern dinosaur's very dinosaur-like call?
So Harris hawks are unique amongst birds of prey and birds in general in that they have highly evolved, very complex cooperative hunting behavior. They're very social for a hawk. And so they actually live and hunt in packs, if you want to think about it like that.
That's
Dave Oliar. I'm the director of long-term monitoring and community science at Hawkwatch International. The researchers that have studied this behavior in Harris's hawks have basically seen that the groups range from two, like a pair, like a breeding pair, up to around seven in size. And so the group will collectively meet to kind of have a kickoff ceremony before a hunt, right? So they'll meet and perch in the same area, and then they'll take off loosely together and search for prey. And they're pretty varied in the food that they take, but most of this cooperative hunting is focused on rabbits and squirrels. So, you know, larger for hawk-sized mammals. And so they'll chase jackrabbits or cotton-tailed rabbits, and they do this together. And it's almost this staged system where They'll be perched out or flying, and one hawk will take the lead and will be chasing down the prey. And if it goes after the rabbit and it misses the rabbit, you know, a trailing hawk picks up the chase, which gives the prey no chance to like rest or get, you know, catch its breath. And so they'll kind of leapfrog over each other, taking turns chasing down the prey until they can catch it. Another strategy that's been documented is that several hawks will approach like one rabbit from multiple directions, right? So that there's really no direction that rabbit has to flee. Like I turn left, oh, boom. I turn right, boom. And so this kind of cooperative, coordinated hunting is really unique in hawks and birds in general. One final thing is that if a rabbit like makes it to its burrow, right, goes down into a hole in the ground to hide, one of these hawks will walk up to there and try to, you know, flush it from the hole by sticking its foot in there. But the rest of the group is surrounding it, waiting to pounce on the prey if it flushes out. Really coordinated. If you watch documentaries like a wolf pack hunting, it's very similar to that. And they've even been referred to as the wolves of the air.
So there's a modern example of dinosaur predators hunting in groups. That's something that Dr. Alan Titus from the Bureau of Land Management pointed out this week as well.
And there is one modern example of a Celurosaur dinosaur, a first cousin, essentially, or second cousin to the Tyrannosaurs today, that actually organizes packs and hunts just like wolves. It's called the Harris hawk, Parabuteo. It lives in the Sonoran Desert. And they form groups of multiple individuals. They have communal raising of the young. They share in kills, and they actually have a division of labor when they hunt, and that lowers the risk to each individual bird so that they can take down much larger prey than they would normally as a lone hawk, such as jackrabbits. So this behavior is possible among dinosaurs, because here is a modern example of a dinosaur doing just what we're saying the tyrannosaurs could have done.
The kind of remarkable fossil trove that Dr. Titus and his colleagues came upon was discovered in the Kaparowitz Plateau, an extremely rich formation for fossil discoveries. But even given that richness, this particular discovery was sort of hard to believe.
We recovered so much bone from so many different kinds of animals over such a wide area, about an acre, that we nicknamed it the Rainbows and Unicorns Site. I consider this a once-in-a-lifetime sort of discovery for myself. I probably won't find another site this exciting and scientifically significant during my career. Although, who knows?
An improbable rainbows and unicorns discovery inside of Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and how it's redefining the way we think about some iconic predators from our planet's ancient past. We'll link to the research that we've been discussing in our In the Hive show post over at kcpw.org. We'll take a quick break in the show and be back with something entirely different. Behind the Headlines is a partnership between two nonprofit news outlets, KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. And what the show does is dissect the week in Utah news. It's a great way of better understanding what's happening in your community. And we hope that you'll tune in to listen and maybe participate in the show. I'm Roger McDonough. Join me, reporters, editors, and columnists from the Salt Lake Tribune for Behind the Headlines, Fridays at 9 and Sundays at 10. Welcome back to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, this show has a broad and eclectic focus. We were just hearing about dinosaur discoveries in a Utah National Monument. Now on the program, we're going to check in with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. It's part of a series of regular conversations we've been having with the DA since before the start of this year's legislative session, and which broadly has had as its focus the concepts of criminal justice reform and police reform. This week, I asked the district attorney about the verdict in the trial against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, well, first off, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. One of my favorite things to do is come down and have this conversation with you. So look forward to it.
Really appreciate it. Hey, I'm talking to you the day after a former police officer in Minneapolis, Derek Chauvin, was found guilty of murder in the killing of George Floyd. While in police custody, there were three charges: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. He was found guilty on all charges. I'm wondering, as you know, as a district attorney, as our district attorney, and someone who is frequently responsible for filing or not filing, in fact, charges against officers who use deadly force, does this verdict change anything for you or the way you handle cases going forward, or the way you think about cases at all?
Well, first of all, it like with many, it gives me hope because I am part of a system, and we have tried to, in a very transparent way, share what we are analyzing, how we're analyzing in an open and inclusive way. And sometimes in doing so, it leads to disappointment, but it also, I think, communicates the structural challenge that we have. That's one of the reasons I've said before, if we want different outcomes, then we need to change the law. And when you look at this decision, it is historic in the sense that it actually went the full count, resulting in a verdict. And then remember, a verdict, a guilt, is only an accounting. And I'm cautious to not call it justice, because as a public prosecutor, when I meet with victims of homicides, I tell them that I cannot bring them justice. Justice would have been that this event never really ever happened. That would be justice. Justice would be the restoration that we don't have Mr. Floyd no longer in the lives of his family. And so when I talk to victims, I cannot give them justice in that sense, because that's not a restoration. And when you look at an incident like this, justice is really about this change that we can have. This is a verdict. This is a guilt. This is an accounting. So when we talk about the disproportionate impact on communities of color and specifically African Americans in the fatal use of lethal force, this is not justice. It's an accounting. And so I think we have to put it in its proper context.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, no, Sim, I was just going to say that, you know, any kind of accounting, whether it be justice or not, when it comes to, you know, cases of police use of force, officers going to trial, you know, that's rare in and of itself, let alone there being a conviction. Just the idea that there may be a trial or charges even being brought that stick.
I think this case really represented something really unique, and I think it was evident in the way this case was presented. So, for example, in this case, we had multiple civilian witnesses. In this case, we had a footage that captured the action in a way that created the ground for the prosecution to be able to come forward with the case. And that was very unique, because that's not present in all cases. The other thing, which is of something historic and significant that we witnessed, was so the prosecution led out with the civilian witnesses in the presentment of the case, and they communicated what they witnessed, and that was captured on video. The other thing historic was that from the chief on down, there was an erosion of the blue wall of silence that has historically plagued our institutions and our ability to bring these cases forward. The chief of police went up there and said, this was unlawful. This is not what they believe in. This is not how he was trained. To have a police chief and then all the other subsequent law enforcement officers from that institution came forward to actually under oath say that is something of almost unique historic presentation. And that was something unique about this case as well.
Do you want to address why that happened? I mean, the fact that, I mean, the case itself is a case in isolation. I mean, you try it that way, but the pressure is there. The public pressure is there on all of those officers.
I think that is something we have to acknowledge here. I think that all of us who live in this space and work on these issues have been hoping for that shift to occur. And this is why I think this feels a little bit qualitatively different. Because when you look at the history of injustice in our country, every 25 or 30 years, we've had these incidents that occur. And there is this rush, and this committees are formed, and people get together. I think something fundamentally, at least hopeful, is happening here. There's an institutional shift that is occurring. And I think that was being witnessed by other chiefs of police and other police departments around this country, that there has been a shift that has occurred, that we are going to look at this critically, and there is an institutional responsibility here, and the chief and the police officers going and cooperating with the prosecution was something very unique that we have not witnessed. And it is something that is sort of culturally been an impediment that's been there. So that was unique about this case. And then that was supplemented by the forensic evidence to meet the burden of proof for causation that the forensic folks were able to come forward, the medical examiners, the medical experts, to actually bring it all the way home. It was the lining up of those three elements together that made it into a compelling case. And we all witnessed it in a public way, which was also unique for that court in Minneapolis. And now, having said that, that is tied to the unique verdict of this case. Let's keep in mind, even as this case was going on, Dante Wright, who was shot and killed there 10 miles from the Brooklyn Center. And then even yesterday, just before this was going to come out, a young child, a 15-year-old in Ohio, was shot. And while this matter was pending in different cities around the country, including our own, these shootings are occurring. So while we can take hope into it, the issue that is that we need to focus on is that that the systemic challenge, the institutional challenge, the political challenge to change our laws, society, and culture, that challenge has not gone away. So the work is really before us. It's an opportunity. It's not the end game at this point. So we cannot lose hope, but we also need to properly understand what the challenge before us is and then change the things that we can and have the difficult conversation for the things that we don't want to.
Wow. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, I'm sorry to have to cut you short, but difficult conversations, a first step towards more difficult conversations ahead. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, as always.
And again, that's Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill wrapping up this episode of In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. Find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.